I can see y'all didn't show me much love when they said impact, but that's okay. I'm up here for an audience of one, so I can live with it. Good morning. Now, real quick, I only got 17 minutes to give an apologetic of why we exist and why this is valuable. But before my minutes are all up, we need to show some love to the crew in the city for a great conference. Is that right? Pray for them, because I know after this week is over, they're going to be exhausted and really self-reflective and criticizing themselves for a great work they've done. But really, God smiled and showed up for us today. Amen. Well, today I want to talk about the reason and the value for contextual discipleship. And we're going to try to address a lot of issues with this. And I want to start with Daniel chapter 1, verse 8. And starting at this important text, as Carla said, and most of us know, the two most important events in the life of Israel was the Exodus and the captivity. And the captivity really, I think, describes a life for many people in the city and on our college campuses who are struggling with what does it mean to represent God when the empire is taken over. You know, in Daniel chapter 1, the scripture says that the Lord used Nebuchadnezzar. He was Hitler before Hitler showed up. In light of bringing Jerusalem under this siege, and from that, he not recruited, but extracted men from them and gave them a full scholarship to the University of Babylon. You know, that was a PBI, primarily Babylonian Institute. And so, but they came in, and before we get to verse 8, here's the reality. He removed their names, their language, their geography, their clothing, their history, the smells that you wake up in the morning that are so familiar with them was gone. And at the end, he immersed them in this reality. And these are guys who are in their early teens, 13, 14, 15 years of age. And Daniel in chapter 1, verse 8, he said, I made up my mind that I would not defile myself. Now, you understand, this is huge. Because in the midst of this, of losing geography, of losing language and name and culture and clothing, losing their name, they were formerly Daniel, he became Belteshazzar. It's like coming from Thabiti and being called Thomas. It's like being Kunta and called Toby. Robbed of all of that. Answering to names that you had to not only learn the language, but you got to remember who you are. Because no one called you by the familiarity of what you were known for where you grew up. And to make that decision in that context was profound and powerful. You know, the problem is, of why this text is so important, is because in the past, evangelicals historically look at this as an ethical or moral or faith reality. But really, this is an ethnicity truth. It was bigger than just his faith. It was bigger than just the reality of just him having an ethical, moral stance. It was an identity true to all of his being. And the place that he stood first was pertaining to his diet. That diet was something God gave them that was prevalent in their society. And he negotiated that with the head or chief of the guard. The interesting and sad thing about it is that the empire has infiltrated the church. You hear foolish statements like God doesn't see color. Is that God redeems our soul and our spirit. Ridiculous comments I've heard, even in my role right now, is that there's no room for a contextual ministry because we need to do a multi-ethnic ministry. Not realizing that a contextual ministry makes a multi-ethnic ministry vibrant and strong when people know who they are and who they belong to. And then we have this foolish notion that multi-ethnicity is really seen in this age of multi-ethnic churches on Sunday morning. That is completely irrelevant. Because multi-ethnicity, as a witness of our faith, is demonstrated during the 6 days of the week. Not when you're 2 hours set aside singing Hillsong songs. Worlds are not changing in that way. And most of all, these empire lies that has infiltrated the church undermines what we think, if we're theologically astute and have a strong orthodox, it undermines two of the most important values that we say we believe: incarnation and resurrection. Take a round, look around at yourself, pull out a mirror. You'll be looking like that for a long time. The only thing's changing is wardrobe, but if you black, baby, you black forever. That's true for white people too. So the reality is, to get this idea that you don't see it, it undermines so much. But you know what? Here's the other thing that people say about this contextual discipleship, that it's just a strategy. That's false too. It's not a strategy. It's an issue of creation. It's an issue that God, in chapter 1, when he was making mankind and all of his creation, each day he ended it with this exceptional word: it is good. It's good. He made you. It was good. But that's not true today. It's not true at all in my neighborhood. It's not true at all in my community. Let's take a quick history lesson and show this first picture I want to show you. In 1954, in Brown versus Board of Education, there was this incredible psychologist named Dr. Kenneth Clark. And he did this incredible study about dolls, putting white kids and black kids in front of the dolls, asking them, which doll do you think is pretty? Which doll do you think is intelligent? Which doll do you think is clean? And the white kids and the black kids were in perfect harmony. Clean was white. Dirty was black. Sullen and ugly was black. Beautiful was white. Dumb and ignorant was black. Intelligent was white. Now you say, oh, that's 1954. That's the past century. 2006, they did it again. And guess what is consistent? From then to now, black kids still look at themselves as dirty and sullen, unintelligent and dumb, and most of all, not beauty. See, a gospel message, it's not telling them that they're sinful. It's reminding them that God not only loves them, he created them beautiful in every shade. But we've lost that reality. You see, I'm married to Jeannie McGee. She's a graphic artist. She graduated from KU. And graphic design. And when we were earlier, in our early years of marriage, she is not only a graphic designer, her minor was textile design, and she loved weaving. And so I got this image when she was talking about weaving about God. God is a weaver. He takes a loom and he weaves things. So in Psalms 139, 13 through 16, the scripture says that in our mother's womb, he was weaving us, creating this beautiful artistic image that's not just for us, but for a piece of glory for him to worship his creation that he's done in us. So I want to introduce you out of Psalms 139, 13 through 16, the idea that there's three wombs of life. Three. Here's the first womb. The first womb is our mother's womb. In that, God gives us noses and ears and personality. He gives us talents and passions. All these things that you can see. I can see your mother in you. Oh, I can see your father. I can see all these things in you. But that's just one aspect of his creation. See, the problem is the narrowness of our thoughts. There's a second womb. And this womb is our ethnicity. That's something beautiful. It's culture. It's mores and emotional interactions and behaviors. It's linguistics. It's diet. It's faith expressions. It's entertainment, music, dance, and games. All of that is stuff that God weaved us in and gave us when he was birthing us in his room. I don't have to pretend what's up. I can do it naturally because it was given to me. And then here's the last one. It's a historical womb. This womb is how the world perceives your ethnic group right now. Right now, at this precise moment. And then how the group perceives itself. That's the issue with what's going on in the world. That's why we need this incredible thing called contextualized ministry. Because we are reminding students every day that God made you in his image. And that God's view of redemption is to live through your redeemed blackness and to be a witness to all people. The tragedy, we're not there. You know, and the tragedy, it just breaks my heart that we have to remind ourselves this. Because we seem to think that we want to repress it, ignore it, hide away, shy away from the idea of who God has made me. And he made me with great intention. Not just, and here's the other part about this, not just to reach my own community. I got a witness anywhere in the world. When I show up in Kenya, black Americans, we're glad you're here. When I'm in Europe, in the Balkans, they want to hear not only of the testimony, they know the rich history and the context and the wounds that I were born for, and they want to know how God has redeemed my life and how the gospel has brought life to me, even in the context of the oppression and suppression and repression of my identity and my people group. That's why Daniel was so incredibly powerful. He made a statement that I know who I am. And I forget, the other thing about this issue, about this whole thing of contextual discipleship, it works well in community. You encourage and remind each other of who you are. I forget, what was his three friends' name? I'm sorry, can y'all help me? Yeah, and you got problems too, because that's not their names. That's their slave names. And you continue to make fun of it. Black churches make fun of it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. After a while, that was funny the first time. It ain't funny no more. If you were to see Kunta today, which name do you think he would respond to? Toby or Kunta? So why do you keep calling these slaves names? And you don't even know them. Without referring to them right now, is Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And let me tell you the difference with these names. Those heathen names were related to idols. Idols that were completely polar opposite of the God they worship. And the names that they have reminded them who they were and whose they were. And yet you keep calling them, like it's kicks and giggles, by their slave names. No indication of their roots and their foundation. No indication of their attachment and their history. See, my ethnic identity is not something to get over. It's something to embrace. It's something that I live through and live with every day that I'm alive. So here's the issue. I love these brothers because they are profound. They got this in college. And our ministry is working with the whole idea of contextual identity and discipleship because we know in those college years, they need to have a sense of firm identity right there. They need to make up their mind. They will have a resolve that they will not defile themselves and let the world creep in and cause them to assimilate or repress their identity, but to be true of their reality. If they do it in college, there's a small chance, just a little bit of chance, that once they leave college, they'll do it the rest of their lives. You know, it says at the end of chapter 1 that they finished top of their class, right? They won a scholarship for 3 years, and they beat all the Babylonians, got employed. In chapter 3, this is the part I like. In chapter 3, the three brothers got promoted. It was because of Daniel. Daniel interpreted the dream, and when Nebuchadnezzar, this tyrant, offered him a promotion, he took people with him. That's what you do, right? Isn't that right? He took people with him. And he said, well, you know what? There's three brothers that I would recommend to you that you should appoint to other higher positions. And so Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah got promoted. And then if you remember in chapter 3, they put up this great idol. And then they had the band playing. Run 51 was getting down. And everybody had to worship in front of this idol when they let loose. But these brothers weren't having it. And it's funny. Listen here. Chapter 1, they removed every aspect of their identity. They were assimilated in. Inwardly, they knew who they were. And when they rebelled, you know what the people around them said? Those exiles of yours did not bow. So isn't it interesting? Even when you think you repress your identity, even when you thought you were assimilated, they still know who you are. So in the midst of that, they go up to the king and say, there's three, those exiles who have not worshiped your idol. He said, bring them dudes up to here. So they came up and Neb said, hey, I've heard that you've not bowed down. And so right now, we're about to let loose. And at that moment, we want you to bow down. Now see, here's what's up. They said, king, O king, let it be clear that our God is able to deliver us. But even if he don't, it don't matter, because we're not getting down. So you can play the music or not, we're not getting down. Neb gets hot. He said, do y'all know who y'all talking to? I am the leader of the known world right now. I just took over your land. I run things. Everything right now. Turn that joker up 10 times, because they're going to burn tonight. The problem was, Nebuchadnezzar didn't know who he was talking to. He wasn't talking to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He was talking to Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. They knew who they were. They knew we weren't going to bow. And see, if you get that practice, that's what we need. We need people who understand their identity, can walk in it, and know that they're agents of God's righteousness and glory, that they dispel the gospel not only with their words but demonstrate it with their life. They understand it with their identity and can walk in it. That's true of my dad, James McGee Jr. He's the only reason why I never changed my name. Because when I say my name, I think of him, all 81 years of him. See, my dad grew up in segregated South. He couldn't go to college, so they shipped him up to Milwaukee School of Engineering until Brown versus Board of Education, they were paying for his education. He eventually met my mom and they got married. We eventually moved to Chicago, and I remember those days when he was a store manager for Firestone Tire and Stores. And he would go drop the money off at the district office and say, son, one day I'll be here. And he did. He ended up being the first district manager for Firestone. Pops, in those times, Ebony used to have the 1,000 most successful blacks each year. My dad was one of them. I was very proud of Pops. I didn't know who he was until I began to grow in my life. What I discovered when Pops went up, you know what he did? He gave every guy my age in the community a job. Every single one of these brothers, they show up on Facebook and say, hey, how you doing, Jimmy? How's your father? I met and talked one of them, Eric Raybon, Bernard we called him. He's been with Firestone for 37 years since my dad gave him that job when he was high school. He's got his college degree. He's moving now to the National Office in Nashville. And see, what my dad did, he knew who he was. My dad reminded himself every day, I'm black and I'm accountable for this great stewardship of my identity and my attachment to community. And so when I go up, I take folk with me. And when white people will go around and remind them that he belongs somewhere else, I never forget this story. He's retired now, so I can say it. One of his managers, a short white man, was rebuking him in front of all of his employees at one of his stores. My dad, I told you, he's James McGee Jr. As they were driving back home, Pops taken on the highway, pulls off on the side on the shoulder of the road and puts it in park and reminds him who he is, that I'm a man just like you. And if you have something to say to me, you don't have to go through my employees. You talk directly with me. Do you understand me? His boss says, yes, sir. They got back in the car and started driving. You say, why is this so valuable? Let me tell you why this is valuable. Because black lives does matter in our organization. Every life matters, but black lives particularly does. And what we're trying to say is that we need people like Daniel, a new generation of Daniels, to show up on the south side of Chicago, in the Hills District of Pittsburgh, in the south central side of LA, wherever in Detroit on the west side, to take over territory and remind people that I'm here and I made up my mind I won't defile myself. Before I end, and I'm getting a little bit over, make it clear, we're fiercely committed to multi-ethnicity. fiercely committed to it, but not at the expense that we have to shelf or repress our identity. Last story, and I'm done. I really am done. I'm getting into my y'all talk time. One of my friends is a pastor in L.A., and I never forget this story, having for years. He's an Asian American who wants to build this eclectic church, and he goes and he's checking out Hiroshima, the jazz group. So while he's there, he's in the backstage, and he's checking out. There's Latinos there, because there's some serious Latino jazz. We know there's black folk there because, you know, we kind of created that joint, right? So we got jazz there. They had white people there and Asians just getting down, celebrating it. So he immediately went backstage. He says, dude, how do you get such a diverse, eclectic audience? Because we want that in our church. He said, let me tell you how we do this. We know who we are. We play Japanese instruments, and we're not ashamed of being Japanese. And because we're confident in our identity, anybody feels welcome in our space. That's what contextual discipleship does. It recognizes that you can see God's beauty and glory and creation in anyone and everyone. And that you can feel at peace in diverse situations. And people who are different from you will feel comfortable with you. I hope you will understand how significant this is, because we got a generation to reach. And sometimes this approach is both strategic, but it's biblical. Is the best way. Thank you.